Laura Kanoy here. Thanks for listening to The Exchange. You'll hear several viewpoints and many interesting questions in this hour from people all over the state. There's no other place in New Hampshire where such a broad array of Granite Staters chime in and foster such a robust exchange of ideas. And as important as you are to the depth of the conversation, you also play a pivotal role in NHPR's finances. We're radio for New Hampshire by New Hampshire. Please click the support button at the top of the page at nhpr.org. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's town meeting season, a time of year when residents dig into the details of local tax and spending decisions and debate what they can afford this year and what they can't. Up for discussion will be the usual big ticket items like police and fire protection, schools, water systems, waste management, roads and bridges. But while demands on municipal government are many, a new report by the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies finds the dollars are becoming ever more scarce, given what it calls downshifting. That's when localities find themselves covering more costs for services that the state used to provide, and the trend has only accelerated. In the last 5 years, per capita state aid to cities and towns dropped by 17%. Meanwhile, municipal governments have had a tougher time closing the gap, given that property values have declined or remained flat. Put together, it's meant a squeeze on local budgets and some tough budgetary decisions, but there are those who say that's appropriate, that the spirit of local control in New Hampshire means just that. And if municipalities really want something, they should pay for it themselves. Today in The Exchange, the lowdown on downshifting. We'll look at this report, the broader issues it raises of who should pay for what in our communities and in our state. Let's hear from you. Do you see this downshifting taking place where you live? When do you think it makes sense for the state to cover certain costs, and when should cities and towns do it on their own? Give us a call, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests for the hour. Elizabeth Dragon is here, president of the Municipal Management Association of New Hampshire, which is composed of appointed local government officials, including town and city managers. Elizabeth is also city manager for the city of Franklin. And Elizabeth, nice to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us on the phone is Ken Weiler, Republican state representative from Kingston, member of the House Finance Committee. He's been in the House for 23 years, with many years on the Finance Committee. And Representative Weiler, good to have you. Thanks for your time this morning.
Delighted to talk about one of my favorite subjects.
Also with us, Daniel Barrick, Deputy Director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, which recently published the report that I mentioned on downshifting costs from the state to the local level. And Dan, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks. Good morning, Laura.
Well, and all of you, and Dan, to you first, before we get into the specifics of this report and start crunching some of those numbers that you guys crunched, Dan, just step back in general, if you could, please. What, in general, do municipalities pay for, and what does the state pay for in general? And then we'll talk about where some of the gray areas are.
Right. Well, depending on how you count the dollars, roughly half of all the state budget, at least the general fund spending, goes to local municipalities. And a good chunk of that goes to schools. But you know, it's kind of hard to disentangle what, you know, what exactly is state spending and what's local spending. It's in the state budget, but a lot of it goes directly to municipalities. And if you've ever been to a town meeting, you've probably heard discussion about, you know, when they're talking about funding something, a state match is available or a grant is available. But on the municipal side, the majority of the local spending comes from the property tax. But the kind of things that you know, say state aid pays for on the local side, ranges from environmental grants to help with the maintenance of water treatment plants, some road grants, a lot of school aid, school construction, special education. So there's a broad range. There's a real tight relationship between the two entities, state and local.
Yeah, and Representative Weiler, we'll talk a little bit later about how you all think it should be done, but how is it done right now, Representative Weiler, that breakdown of who's responsible for what?
Basically, the people are paying for everything. It's a matter of whether they pay directly or indirectly, or whether they pay through their property taxes, whether they pay through gasoline taxes, whether they pay through dealing with a business that then pays business taxes, whether they pay cigarette taxes, and so on. And All the money comes from the people.
All the money comes from the people, and then it goes to certain pots, cities and towns. And I wonder what you think, Representative Wyler, about what cities and towns often complain about, unfunded mandates from the state, where the state passes a law that has a cost associated with it, and the towns say, hey, this is expensive, we don't want to pay for this.
There are many of us in the legislature that bring that point up constantly, that say this is an unfunded mandate, and there's, all of us are very aware of that fact. And yet some of these things, they're debatable as to whether or not they're unfunded. If you're giving $1 billion for education, and then you're saying we want you to do this or that in education, and of course the educators are the worst people at spending money and never accounting for it. And so they're always going to say, oh, well, you didn't give us the money for that. And we figure, well, we gave you $1 billion. We have the right to tell you how to spend it. And that's the thing they usually complain about.
You know, Elizabeth Dragon, I want to pick up on that point about educators in just a minute, Representative Wyler. But to you, Elizabeth Dragon, too, there you are at the local level, city manager for Franklin and with the group Municipal Management Association, which is cities and towns. What's your perspective on who pays for what and how good or not good a balance we have right now?
Well, I agree with the representative. The people are paying for everything. It is just how we distribute those funds. The concern over the last few years has been some of the commitments that the state has made to its towns and cities and suspending those commitments, and really on such short-term notice that it's put the towns and cities in a difficult predicament to try and balance their budgets. I remember one year, many of the towns had already adopted their budget. They had already attended March town meeting, and they were really at a loss as to how to make up the revenue that was being held by the state.
So is the problem, Elizabeth, in your opinion, the amounts of money or more just the different time schedules? Cities and towns are sort of on one time schedule and the legislature's on another time schedule.
Oh, no, it's the amounts for sure. I think the time schedule was very difficult, but it's definitely the amount of money that's no longer being distributed to the towns and cities.
And when did you see a shift beginning in terms of, you know, this downshifting trend? I'm going to talk about it a little bit more, but go ahead, Elizabeth.
Well, it depends on which pot of money we're talking about. They have come at different times. In the meals and rooms, we saw that the shift started when they, I think it was about fiscal year 2012. In the revenue sharing, it's all the way back to fiscal year 2009. So it really depends. And then the retirement, we know that happened over the course of several years where the state was contributing 35%, it went down to 30, then 25, and then eliminated it altogether. So it's really been over the course of, let's say, 5 years, the different pots of money have been impacted.
Right. And I hear you. It does depend on which sort of grant and which program you're talking about. Dan Barrick, you crunched the numbers on this. What did you find in terms of the trends?
Well, there's really, and it's not surprising, this report we put out is an annual a report we put out annually for years just to track trends in municipal finance. But the findings of this year's is very much consistent with those of the last few years since the recession. And it's not surprising that there's really two distinct periods. There was the pre-recession, you know, up till about 2007, 2008, in which municipal government saw pretty steady, consistent levels of state aid, increasing about 2% a year, and municipal spending increased at roughly the same rate. And since the recession, there's been a real change in that trend, sort of roughly from 2008. And as Elizabeth said, different types of programs, different pots of money, but a general decline, steady decline in state assistance to local communities, and a real parallel flattening of spending on the local side as well.
And again,
to compensate for that in part.
Elizabeth, go ahead, and then I want to ask Representative Wyler
another
question.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, as times got tough, I think the state was looking at how to balance their budget. The problem is, so were the towns and cities. And shifting some of those expenses down to the towns and cities at the very time that we are also struggling made it most difficult for us. So I think you're right. It's when the recession and the economy, we started to see signs of the recession that's when money began to get tight at both the state and the local level.
Yeah, it's tough, though, because the state has to balance its budget just like cities and towns do. So did you want to jump in real quick there?
Yeah, you're right. The state does have to balance their budget, and I understand that that is a very difficult process. However, in my opinion, shifting commitments that the state had made and down to the local level isn't actually balancing the budget. It's just shifting it down to the local taxpayer.
Well, so Representative Wiley, let's bring you in on that too. A familiar complaint that, you know, the state balances its budget, quote unquote, on the backs of local towns. We've heard people say that in the past. What do you think? What's your perspective as a state lawmaker?
Once the economy took a tumble in 2009, there wasn't much anybody could do to bring new money that wasn't there. We did get the $700 or $800 million in stimulus funds, and in some ways that skewed everything we did in our plan.
Softened the blow a little bit, yeah.
The challenge we have at the state level that doesn't exist at the local level is when I sit in the Finance Committee and we try to come up with a spending plan to forecast 27 months ahead, and that's very difficult, and especially the fact we have over 20 different sources of revenue, not just the main one. And so we have to juggle all those and try to estimate 27 months in advance how they will be and whether they will cover everything that we're trying to do. And that's quite a challenge. And then when the $800 million in stimulus came in, that was, in some cases, it triggered overspending in some areas, and it caused some hiring that shouldn't have been done. And the money wasn't probably distributed as best it could. And we were still having a struggle, and the people that were in charge of the budget, that was the first time that the Democrats had come into the majority, and they didn't want to listen to those of us that had been in charge, and they overestimated the revenue in two different budgets, and then drastic cuts had to be made, which that was when some of the effects on the towns came, because the two-year budget, after 1 year, they saw they'd made a $200 million error. And so they made some drastic cuts that did have effects on the town, because they had overestimated the revenue, and we're arguing about that again this time. But, you know, the Democrats are not quite calling all the shots. They're in charge in the House, but not in the Senate.
Yeah,
so we'll see how it all works out.
Definitely makes for an interesting budget year. And I want to invite our listeners to join us as well. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Join us as we look at this idea of downshifting and the broader question it raises. Who should pay for what in our communities and in our state? Where do you think it makes sense for the state to cover certain costs? When should cities and towns do it on their own? Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be back in just a minute. We're going to check in now with our March membership drive.
Thanks so much, Laura. I'm Rick Gantley. This is NHPR's Spring March Membership Drive. And today it's All the Money, Half the Time Tuesday. We're trying to raise our $35,000 goal for the day all by 1 o'clock. And if we meet that goal, then the rest of the day is fundraising free. So giving now, 1-888-805-6477. That's the number to call. Giving now keeps the exchange, keeps Morning Edition, keeps Diane Rehm on the air, and helps keep on-air fundraising to a minimum. Right now with more, Sarah Ashworth.
Good morning, everybody, and we are breaking up that goal a little bit now. We are trying to raise $6,000 in the next 40 minutes. You can help us reach this goal. All the money goes toward programming, bringing you programs like Morning Edition and The Exchange and Word of Mouth. You can make your pledge this morning at 1-888-805-6477, or you can go online to nhpr.org.
News stories and other radio stations and other media, they're short. They're driven by sound bites. They're short in order to accommodate advertising. Now, here at NHPR, we believe it takes time to tell a story in comprehensive fashion. It takes time to have an in-depth conversation. And because we're commercial-free, we have that time. That means you get all the details you need to fully understand a topic or a story. Support that kind of programming with your gift right now. NHPR.org, that's the web address. You can give us a call, 1-888-805-6477. 805 6477.
And here is what we're trying to do on this Tuesday morning. We would like to cut the fundraising day in half today, and I'm sure all of you would love to hear that as well. We're calling it It's All the Money, Half the Time Tuesday. If we raise $35,000 by 1 o'clock today, then we get the rest of the day fundraising free. You can help us meet this big, ambitious goal and get us back to uninterrupted programming this afternoon. We will only do it, though, when we reach that $35,000 mark by 1 o'clock. Help us get there this morning. Make a pledge at nhpr.org or call 1-888-805-6477.
One of our thank you gifts is the NHPR fleece blanket. Today, we'll thank you for your $180 donation with not one, but two of our fleece blankets. It's a blue blanket with the NHPR logo in green. It'll keep you warm and show your support for your favorite public radio station. You can get that now. Give us a call, 1-888-805-6477. Go online, see the blanket, and make your gift at nhpr.org.
And like other strong nonprofit organizations right here in New Hampshire, NHPR, it's funded with voluntary contributions. They range from a few dollars to a few thousand dollars. We're asking you this morning to choose the amount that fits your budget and reflects the value that you see NHPR bringing to your life and to New Hampshire. That could be $120. It could be $1,000 or $2,500 if it's in your means. That ensures that NPR and NHPR programs, those programs that you want, they always are going to have a home on the radio here at NHPR. Help us make our goal today. Help us continue to keep the programming on the air at nhpr.org or call 1-888-805-6477.
Now, we have a big goal this hour, but we have a big reward. We are trying to raise $6,000 in the next 38 minutes. Now, these hourly goals, they're really important to stay on track to meet our overall goal for this fund drive, and they're very important today so that we can end our fundraising at 1 o'clock and give you uninterrupted programming this afternoon. Give us a call. Help us reach this ambitious goal. NHPR.org is the web address, but you can also call us at 1-888-805-6477.
And we're only going to take about 2 minutes of your time this morning to make a pledge. That's all it takes. We need your name and contact information, which we keep private. You can become a sustaining member using a Visa, a MasterCard, and an American Express or a Discover card. You can also use your checking account. You can also make a one-time gift if that's a little bit easier on your wallet. But please give now before the day slips away. 1-888-805-6477 or go online, make your pledge at nhpr.org.
$5,800 to go in the next 37 minutes. We can do it when we all do our part. Give us a call right now, 1-888-805-6477. Make your gift safely and securely and quickly online at nhpr.org. And thanks.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from AutoBeef, a website providing information for vehicle owners about squeaks, bangs, flashing lights, odd smells, and other vehicle complaints. Online at carcomplaints.com. And from Hillsborough House, a locally owned nursing facility improving the experience and delivery of rehab and residential care for over 50 years. Information at hillsboroughhouse.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, for town meeting season, we're looking at the changing relationship between state and local financing, what some localities call downshifting as the state faces budget pressures. It is, in some cases, cutting, reducing some of the state aid that used to give to cities and towns. 1-800-892-6477 is our number for you to join us. What do you notice in your community in terms of this trend? Where do you think it does make sense for the state to pick up the costs? And when should cities and towns do it on their own? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, Representative Weiler, I did want to go back to you. What are your thoughts, your broad thoughts on that question I just asked for the audience? When do you think, Representative Weiler, it does make sense for the state to cover certain costs? And when should cities and towns do it on their own? Just real broadly, what do you think? What categories make sense to you?
Well, we've spent a great deal of money on Medicaid. It's one of our biggest entitlements, and the state obviously has to pick that up because it's difficult for the towns and cities when you have a larger population that you can spread the risk over. It makes sense. All the insurance pools tell you that.
Sure.
So that's one that does make sense. But education has always been a local, and one of the some of the Claremont lawsuits we had, it was determined that the closer to home those decisions are made, the better. So the education funding, which drives all of our budgets, it's in our towns, it's like 85% of all our property taxes go to school funding. And the surprising thing is that over the last 10 years, there's been a big decline in enrollment in the schools, and that under 18 population continues to decline, even under the 5-year-old. So that there should have been reductions in school spending, but there never was. They kept climbing, and spending kept increasing, and the usual cry of the educators was, if only someone else would pay their fair share, just as the same one we hear from the liberals, oh, the rich have to pay their fair share, so it's always someone else needs to pay more, but they never are accountable, and they never bother to cut their spending, no matter what the enrollment is, and that's the problem we're facing.
Some of the, and we could do a whole many, many hours on school costs and so forth, but some of the arguments, and I'm sure you've heard these, Representative Weiler, is that it's unfair for kids in, you know, Berlin or Claremont to have less of a good education than a kid in Hollis or Bedford, and that, you know, we all reap the benefits of having an educated populace statewide, so that there should be more sharing among cities and towns. That's a longstanding argument there for making education more of a state responsibility. I just wonder what you think about that.
We're it's roughly 20% of all the entire state spending. It's over $1 billion, as I'm looking at the chart before me that shows schedule of state aid to cities, towns, and school districts. And from 11 to 12, or from 12 to 13, rather, it was like a 1% drop in what the total that the state delivered to the cities and towns. So the downshifting, I think, is greatly exaggerated in total, but in various areas, there is definite downshifting. But in total, the extra money has all had to go for education despite this declining enrollment.
Again, our number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. As town meetings get underway here in the Granite State, we want your thoughts on how cities and towns are renegotiating constantly this financial relationship. Some say downshifting is going on. Others say not necessarily. Our number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And all of you, here's a Facebook comment from Heidi, who says, very timely topic. The city of Dover is grappling with some very tough decisions regarding next year's school budget, such as charging for full-day kindergarten, cutting 20 staff positions, primarily because of the end of the state's retirement plan match and other reductions in state support. Now, Elizabeth Dragon, this is getting really detailed, but it's an important point. Up until, as I understand, about 5 years ago, the state used to match the pension costs and so forth for local public employees, firefighters, police, teachers, and that's slowly dwindled, right? Right now it's all up to the towns to fund those pensions and so forth, retirement costs.
That's correct. It went from 35% to 30% to 25% to zero.
I remember John Lynch got that rolling, didn't he?
I believe that's correct. And, you know, the frustrating part about the retirement piece, first of all, it's very expensive for all of us at the state and at the local level. But the communities signed on to the retirement plan with the state of New Hampshire with the promise and commitment of this 35% match. And now we are left with no match from the state and a plan that we have no choice in. We cannot get out of the plan. Once you're in the plan. And if we got out of the plan, then there would be even more financial issues for the retirement system as a whole. So that was something that really impacted all of our communities. And I just want to give you a quick example just for my upcoming budget in the city of Franklin. The city of Franklin has a tax cap, and we have calculated that the city portion of the tax cap that we are able to raise the budget in fiscal year 14 is $122,000 approximately. The retirement is $150,000. just the retirement for the city. That's not including the school. So right there, I have to cut the budget, cut services.
Recreation, roads,
right,
water, whatever.
To come up with that commitment and the retirement system. It's been a difficult process for all of the towns and cities to go through.
Make the case, though, Elizabeth, if you could. Here's the other side of it. Let's say I live in Concord. So let's say we have a really generous retirement plan for our local public employees. When the state was matching that at a pretty generous match, you could say 35%, I think you said.
Right.
Why should taxpayers in Franklin help subsidize the cost of our, you know, let's just say Concord has a super generous retirement plan. I'm not saying that they do necessarily, but do you get what I'm saying? Why should statewide taxpayers fund individual cities or towns who choose to be very generous?
I guess I'm confused by that question because we all have the same retirement plan.
It's all the
same.
I see. So it's not like Concord can vote in
a more generous. No.
I see what you're saying. Okay. So that's a whole pool
it's
that
defined.
Matches statewide.
It's a defined benefit.
Well, the difference comes with who gives big pay raise increases. So that's the part that was unsustainable at the state level. When, as I said before, I'm trying to project 27 months in advance the spending plan for the state. During that 27 months, every time someone gives a 6% pay raise, or in some cases, the police chief's going to get 2 years' pay if he just resigns and leaves early and so on and so forth, all those things had to be matched by the state. And that's so unpredictable that could be a $20 million swing in what I have to put in for the state's contribution. My Democrat colleagues had reduced it to 30%, and then 25%. What we tried to do as a tactic was to increase the contribution by the employees to make up for the 25%, and we reduced it to $13 million to make up the difference, but basically we expected the employees, who are really the prime beneficiaries, to pick up the major cost and the major increase. In some cases, they were paying only a third or a fourth of the total contribution that went to their retirement, and that didn't seem balanced. So we thought they can easily pick up a little bit more, and we increased the teachers from 5% to 7%, while the employer was still paying 14%. So that helped pick up the slack that the state was supposed to chip in, and it did in a large case. But now what's happened is the total system is basically bankrupt. And in a real world, we just would have declared bankruptcy and changed the whole system. But you can't do that easily in government, so you have to do something else. So they keep increasing the contribution required from the employer.
The towns, the cities,
yeah. You should increase as well the amount required of the employee. And some of my colleagues in Utah did this till the employees realized, wow, this system is unsustainable, and they voluntarily changed it to a defined contribution system versus the present system of defined benefit.
So all right, let's
that's
some
something you have to transition to.
Sure, and it sounds like maybe there's a whole show in the making just on this pension issue. But let's go to our listeners again. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Steve's calling from Concord. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. I was in the legislature decades ago when we first invited the municipal employees to participate in the pension system, and like a lot of good ideas, it seemed to make sense at the time because a lot of towns found it very difficult to negotiate with the union contracts for the different contracts. It took up a lot of time, particularly for towns that have part-time selectmen. There was no uniformity. It made it hard for employees who might move from one town to another to get a job. So it seemed like a good idea at the time, but over time what we found is because a lot of communities knew that the state was picking up a substantial part of this, perhaps they didn't negotiate their contracts quite as adroitly or aggressively as they should have, because they always said, well, the state's picking up part of it. So even though I know it's been very hard on communities, like we heard from Franklin, I think Representative Weiler has pointed out we have a system that is essentially completely underwater, a major change needs to be made. And it was an idea that seemed like a good idea at the time, but it really did not make sense from a state point of view because essentially it was a blank check. And I know it's a hard adjustment, and we've got a long way to go before we bail out the pension system and are fair to the people who paid in and the employees who've worked hard. But the idea of the state underwriting part of municipalities' retirement costs made no sense, and I think that's why Governor Lynch started that.
Yeah, but. And Steve, thank you for the call. And so, Dan, your thoughts on this pension issue, and then I do want to move on to some other issues in terms of municipal and state finance.
Well, I think more broadly, it's a good example of the double nature of this problem here. So you've got a state and local relationship. The state provides funding for certain programs, and that funding may be decreasing because of pressure from the recession and elsewhere. But at the same time, if you're not rethinking the policy behind that program, and asking the question, can we still provide the same, meet the goals of this program as designed at a lower level of funding? Maybe we need to redesign it. And I think that's what they tried to do with the pension system, is rather than, you know, they decreased the state share, but also lawmakers, as Representative Weiler indicated, tried to redesign it to be more efficient, try and increase the employee contribution. But that's an underlying tension, I think, in this whole debate is if you're going to decrease the funding, should you also use that as an opportunity to rethink the program that you're paying for to make sure that it's still able to meet the goals that you originally had for it? Another example was a school building aid program. State statute provides that, you know, when a local school district is going to build a new school, that's a big undertaking. The state will provide a certain amount of match for those costs. That program had been increasing in cost for years. The legislature decided to suspend it in 2009 because they said they can't afford it. And that suspension has stayed in effect. And you know, you've got this program that's ostensibly in place at a certain design, but it's not being funded. And last year, for the first time, the legislature tried to redefine it and say, well, instead of paying for every project, let's put in a waiting list and we'll actually rank projects. It was an example of trying to actually redefine the policy rather than just lowball the funding. Say, if we're only can afford this amount, how can we make this the best program possible at that level? And I think there's a number of instances where that kind of conversation needs to be had throughout state and local financing.
So don't just look at the dollars and compare it year over year. Say, all right, there's fewer dollars, so what are we really trying to do
here? How can we make the most of this? And there's a lot of questions about, you know, it could lead to discussions about regionalization of services and other questions.
Well, I've actually got an email to that effect about regionalization of services, but I will save it for after a short break. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. If you're on the line, stay there. We'll try to take your call when we come back from a short break. We're going to check in now, though, with our March Fund Drive.
And good morning. I'm Rick Ganley on listener-supported New Hampshire Public Radio. Today is All the Money, Half the Time Tuesday. Now, we're trying to raise our $35,000 goal for the day by 1 p.m. Now, when we meet that goal, the rest of the day will be fundraising free. We count on listeners like you for the money we need to pay for the exchange and for news reports and analysis and discussion that you depend on each day. Now, you can do your part by becoming a sustaining member at NHPR. Give us a call at 1-888-805-6477 or become a member at NHPR.org. Joining us now is Sarah Ashworth.
And good morning. We are still looking to raise $5,700 in listener contributions in the next 21 minutes. Meeting this hour's goal is important because it ensures we can continue to bring you the exchange and all of the other programs that are lined up for the rest of today and for the months to come. Please give online at NHPR.org, or you can give us a call. Call right now at 1-888-805-6477.
Listener support makes over 40% of the total revenue for New Hampshire Public Radio. So getting more members, just 1 or 2% more, makes a huge difference. So if NHPR means something to you, become a member right now and make your voice heard. Give us a call at 1-888-805-6477. 805-6477. Help support New Hampshire Public Radio with a gift at nhpr.org.
And not every station around the country, there are so many public radio stations, but not many of them have a program like The Exchange, where you can call in and talk about issues of the day with such a knowledgeable host as Laura Kanoy and a great producing team behind her. It's that kind of program we're asking you to support today. Make a call at 1-888-805-6477. We'd love to hear from all of you fans of The Exchange. Make a pledge at nhpr.org.
And it's a two-for-one deal we're only offering for today. Get a blanket for yourself and another for a loved one with your $180 gift or when you become a sustainer at $15 a month. Take a look at it right now on our website and some of our other thank you gifts as well while you're there at nhpr.org. You can also make your gift online or by calling 1-888-805-6477.
We are trying to cut the fundraising in half today. It's All the Money, Half the Time Tuesday, and this is how we're going to do it. When we raise $35,000 by 1 o'clock today, then we get the rest of the day fundraising free. Help us meet this big, ambitious goal and get back to uninterrupted programming this afternoon. We can only do it with your help. Call 1-888-805-6477 or go online to nhpr.org.
We are looking to raise $5,700 in the next 21 minutes. Help us meet this goal. Meeting it will ensure that NHPR has the money needed to pay for The Exchange and all the programs that come out of your radio each and every day. Please call 1-888-805-6477. Help us meet this ambitious goal. When we raise this money, we are looking to be pledge-free this afternoon. You can help us get there. Give online at nhpr.org.
And becoming a monthly sustainer to NHPR is the best way to support the station. It's also one of the easiest ways to support the station. It takes just a few minutes to set up. You can consider starting a membership at $10 or $15 a month or $100 a month. You can choose the level that's right for you. It's paperless, meaning you won't receive the usual renewals in the mail. It's up to you to set the amount. Do it today at nhpr.org. Or give us a call, the number 1-888-805-6477.
It really is easy to do, and it might be the most efficient thing you do all day. It's very easy to do. It just takes 2 minutes of your time. You just provide your name, contact information, how much you'd like to give, and which credit card you'd like to use. And your financial support will become the stories and programs that will continue to keep coming out of your radio and keep you connected to New Hampshire and the world. It just takes 2 minutes of your time. 1-888-805-6477. That's the number to call. You could also do it safely and securely online and very quickly at nhpr.org.
If you're undecided about how much to give, consider becoming a sustaining member at the $10 a month level. It's billed to your credit card. It renews automatically. And you know that no matter when you tune in to NHPR or pull it up on your mobile device, you're always doing your part to bring the programming to you and to many other listeners around the state. Make your pledge this morning at nhpr.org.
Looking to raise $5,600 in the next 18 minutes or so, give us a call. Do your part by calling 1-888-805-6477. Go online to nhpr.org. And thanks.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from New Hampshire's community colleges committed to increasing the number of science, technology, engineering, and math graduates in New Hampshire, ccsnh.edu. And the Spine Center at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, using research results to build customized treatment plans. Information at dhspine.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, the gas tax debate accelerates. Should New Hampshire raise the gas tax or not? Email us your thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at how cities and towns are renegotiating their financial relationships. Some towns these days are complaining about what they call downshifting, but some at the state level are saying if cities and towns really want certain programs, they should pay for them themselves. What are your thoughts on this conversation? join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And here's an email from Doug, all of you, that gets to something that Dan Barrick raised before the break. Doug says, what about the responsibility of the town? Towns of 1,000 people have 3 fire trucks and a police department. Why isn't there more sharing of resources amongst the towns? Doug, thanks for the email. And Elizabeth Dragon, I wonder what you think.
I just want to respond real quick about the revenue picture in general in terms of a couple of items. Meals and room distribution and revenue sharing are a couple of revenue pots of money that comes into the state that are collected in our communities. And just revenue sharing in particular, I know that the city of Concord has lost over $4.6 million since 2010 in revenue sharing.
From the rooms and meals tax.
From revenue sharing. And really, to kind of give you a sense of why this is downshifting. In 1969, when the government decided to reform the manner in which the state taxed businesses, they, in consideration of the removal of a certain class of property from taxation, they came up with this plan of sharing that revenue that they're collecting in the individual cities and towns with the cities and towns, because property was being taken from their tax rolls.
Like nonprofits and religious organizations,
right,
and government organizations are not, their property is not taxed. So for college towns, for government towns like Concord, this is sometimes a problem.
Right. The business profit tax is really what we're talking about. And so they removed that from the cities and towns. They reformed how that money was being collected back in 1969. And then when this recession hit and we started to impact these pots of money that were coming back to the communities, the revenue sharing was suspended. And like meals and rooms, that's money that's collected in the individual communities and not coming back to the community. So I just wanted to touch on that as a really important topic to think about as we move forward. And the issue of regionalization, many communities already are looking at regionalization. I know in Franklin, we have looked at sharing various things. We dispatch for a number of communities. We have recently created a memorandum of understanding with a couple of communities to share some code enforcement responsibilities. We have done some private-public partnerships with organizations. Last year, a couple years ago, when we closed a school building, we changed that building into a community center by bringing in and partnering with other nonprofits in the region.
So to answer his email, it is going on.
It is definitely going on. And I think it's at different levels, at different communities. But I know that the planning commissions, the regional planning commissions, are also looking at this idea and how to really change the way we do business.
All right, well, let's take another call if we could. Thanks for that email, Doug. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Larry's waiting in Loudoun. Hi, Larry. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Frequent listener. We have an opportunity right now to minimize some of the downshifting that's going on to towns. There's a bill in the House to increase the gas tax, which is really a road toll that is collected at the pumps and levied on people who are using the roads. The more you use them, the more you pay. In my town alone, we are considering raising property taxes by 22 cents per thousand to do some road repairs in this coming year. So that's a one-year fix that is going to be left up to the individual voters in the town to consider. And it's not a great way to do any planning on the local level. And what a lot of motorists probably don't know and a lot of citizens probably don't know is that the money that goes to DOT from the gas tax, 12% of that, gets distributed back out into the municipalities for roads and bridge repairs.
Not just for state highways and state bridges, but it goes to localities too. Is that what you're saying, Larry?
Yeah. That is correct, yes.
Well, Larry, perfect chance for me to again promote tomorrow's program. We're talking about the gas tax. But Representative Weiler, tie in the link that Larry's making between the gas tax and this idea of downshifting. I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, that is one way that the state can share the highway block grant aid that goes to all the municipalities to help pay for their roads. It's 12%, as Larry correctly says, and I believe there will be some increase in the gas tax. There hasn't been one since 1991. And in some of the data we've looked at since, the payroll has doubled in the Department of Transportation. The cost of asphalt has gone up 500%. And, you know, salt similarly. So there's growing expenses. Meanwhile, everybody's mileage is getting better. So you're covering the same wear and tear on the road using less gasoline and paying less tax. And those 1% or so that are driving electric vehicles are paying nothing. So there has to be something happen to increase the amount of money flowing to the Department of Transportation. I'm sure that the gas tax at some form will pass. I don't think it will be 15 cents over the 4 years as was passed recently in the House. I think and it's gone again to the Ways and Means Committee, which may make another change to it, and then it will go to the Senate, which may change it again.
All right.
I think it will go up, but I don't think it will go up 15 cents. But I'm pleased that that's money that will be going back to the cities and towns to help with the roads that they maintain.
Well, and again, Larry, thanks for that call. We'll be looking at this in more detail tomorrow on The Exchange. I'd like to bring in one more caller, if I could. This is Tim in Canaan. Hi, Tim. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. How are you doing?
Good.
Good. I live in the Mount Sonoma School District, and 5 years ago when states were kicking in money for new construction and renovation, we had a bond article to build a new high school because our high school is 50 years old. It is in dire need of repair. It was voted down, and so now with no kick-in from the state, we have to do renovations, and it's costing us about $22, $25 million. So that's a huge chunk, and that's just for renovating the high school. And a lot of the common argument against it is declining enrollment. But, I mean, fewer kids doesn't mean the roof leaks less or the boiler doesn't break as often. You know, so these are dire repairs that we need in order to keep our accreditation because we're at risk of losing our accreditation. So that's kind of one way that the state, you know, has not contributed, and it falls on the local level.
Yeah, Tim, thanks a lot for calling in. Dan Barrick, your thoughts? I'm wondering if you guys looked at this when you looked at, you know, local versus state financing.
On the school building aid mm-hmm. program? Yeah, I mean, that's a big one. The way the program's structured is that there's a certain amount of money that so the state agrees to pay a share of the bond over the life of the bond for each town's project. 30% is the average. That older obligation for projects that have already been approved at the local level and in some cases have already been completed eats up around $40 million a year. In the most recent reform, the legislature capped school building aid at $50 million a year, leaves a very small slice for new construction, such as the one your caller mentioned. And for that small piece, there's now a waiting list, and you know the state will be prioritizing those projects where there's
so it's a lot tougher to get it.
Yeah, there's a lot less money. So in order to, it used to be essentially a come one, come all program. Everyone who applied who had a legitimate building project, as long as they got local approval, would get some state aid. I think their effort was to say, we've got less money, let's prioritize it. That doesn't mean on a case-by-case basis, such as perhaps the one your caller mentioned, there are, projects that are going to be delayed. There's going to be needs that are going to be put off or unmet. But I think it was a honest effort to realign the outcomes of a program, the way it could operate efficiently with the financial limits that have been placed on it.
Yeah, and in the end, and of course, the budget is an ongoing process. As people often say, it takes three to tango, the governor, the House, and the Senate. But what do you think, Representative Wyler, when things shake out in the end, will cities and towns be feeling okay about what they're getting from the state, or do you think there'll still be more complaints about downshifting?
The education lobby continues to push the same thing. Now, in many cases, if they don't maintain the building, that's a local responsibility. We're not responsible to fix the roof and so on. And so in many cases, the maintenance programs have been not kept up with as they should have been. So now they want a new building where they should have maintained the old building a little better. One of the things, again, that I come to is trying to forecast 2 years in advance. It used to be you'd know the projects well in advance, and then you'd know when the funding was coming because they had to go to the school approval. They had to go to school meeting approval, and then they had to plan the project. So you knew well in advance over a year of when the money was likely to be spent. Then they've come up with a new way of financing in recent years where more money is up front, which made it very difficult for us to forecast that school building aid all those months in advance.
Us meaning you at the state level.
Yeah, at the state level. So we weren't able to forecast how much money we'd put in there and how the projects would be done. And as I said, if they do the maintenance, then they don't need as much new construction. And if you got declining enrollment, why do you need new construction? So those are the things that are troubling us. We'd like to help people, but that money just kept growing and growing, and we weren't able to keep up with it.
Dan, real quick, and then we got to close
out. I think Representative Weiler's points are right and reflect some of the strains on the program. You'd hear from the school side, from the administrator side, that the last few years, the uncertainty in this program in particular, is it under a moratorium, is it not, is it capped, has led to uncertainty on their side about, on the local voters. Well, if we approve this project, will we get that 30% state match, which is a big deal. So there's uncertainty on both sides, and I think, that's an underlying tension here.
And Tim from Canaan, our caller, says, look, it doesn't matter if you've got 50 kids or 75 kids, your roof still leaks. So I do need to wrap it up with all of you, and I want to thank you very much for being with us this hour. Thanks a lot. This is The Exchange on NHPR, checking in real quickly now with our March Fund Drive.
And thanks, Laura. I'm Rick Ganley. This is New Hampshire Public Radio's March Membership Drive. And we're trying to keep our fundraisers short here at the station today. All the money, half the time Tuesday. That's what we're doing right now. We're trying to raise $35,000 by 1 p.m. When we meet that goal, the rest of the day, fundraising free. You can do your part right now. Give us a call at 1-888-805-6477. Go online to nhpr.org. Here with more, Sarah Ashworth.
Good morning. And on this town meeting day, we are hearing from so many people around the state who are pledging gifts to NHPR. We've heard from Susan and Paul in Lebanon, who says, it's simply my favorite station. Jane in Bartlett pledged and says, it is such a great source of information and entertainment. And Mary Ellen and Philip in Stratford, they write in and say that they listen all the time and it's their main source of news. Those comments are so great to hear, and I know that they resonate with so many of you as well. We're asking you to translate that into making a pledge this morning. Call 1-888-805-6477 or go online to nhpr.org.
We have a thank you gift today, and today only, in fact. Your $180 donation will get you not one, but two of our fleece blankets. It's a blue blanket with the NHPR logo in green. It'll keep you warm, and it'll help show your support for your favorite public radio station. We can get you two for one right now today, but give us a call, 1-888-805-6477. Go online. You can see the blanket at nhpr.org and make your gift there.
And listener support, it accounts for more than 40% of our budget. Federal funding accounts for less than 7%. That's a big difference between those two numbers, and it's why you are so important during these fund drives. It's why every call and every pledge really does make a difference. We're asking you to join in and be part of it today. Show your support of The Exchange. Show your support of the upcoming Diane Rehm Show. Call 1-888-